So, what's on my mind to talk about today is karma. And karma is in many ways an interesting topic, and it lends itself to a wide range of associations. The word karma has come to the West from other places besides the Buddhist uses of the word, from Hindu uses of various kinds, and other places. And so it's now entered the English language, and we say it's pretty common. People talk about karma in some ways, kind of colloquially, you know, you had good parking karma. you don't have it? As I understand the concept, it is very central to Buddhism, and it's also, in its essence, something you probably already have faith in or confidence in or believe in, something you already understand. It's pretty much of a simple, straightforward idea at its heart. So much so that one person recently I was talking to said, oh, he doesn't really think about karma. It's not really an important part of his practice. He's a Vipassana teacher. However, I think it's already kind of deeply part of how he sees the world. He just doesn't think about it along those lines. To give you some sense of how important the idea of karma is in Buddhism, the Dalai Lama once said, and other teachers have said the same thing, but in his case, he was talking about emptiness. Maybe he was going to give a talk about the Mahayana philosophy of emptiness. And this in Mahayana Buddhism is one of the ultimate teachings, one of the great, most profound teachings, is teachings on emptiness. And people strive for years to really grapple, understand, and be transformed through the understanding or perception or experience of emptiness. And the Dalai Lama said, more important than understanding emptiness is to understand karma. So it's more important. And part of the reason for that is karma is basically a doctrine of cause and effect. And if you don't really understand cause and effect, but you understand emptiness, it can lend itself to being antinomian. It can lend itself to you feeling anything goes. You don't have to pay attention to cause and effect. You don't have to be moral or be ethical in any way. You can just do whatever you want. So he said it's more important to understand karma than it is to understand emptiness. Another place where you see the centrality of the notion of karma is in the experience of the Buddha's awakening, his enlightenment experience, with the night of his enlightenment. We don't have a lot of descriptions of what the experience of the Buddha's enlightenment was like. And in fact, most of us don't say, oh, there's not an experience I recognize there, maybe, as kind of being enlightenment in terms of white light or great bliss or explosion of something or other, or whatever, you know, great mythic ideas we have of enlightenment. Now, his enlightenment perhaps is understood in mythic terms, a mythic story. It's hard to know whether to take this as myth or as being real. But in the night of his enlightenment, the night was divided into three parts, three watches of the night. And the first watch of the night, he perceived his past lives. And it said that he was able to perceive his past lives 1,000, 10,000, 100,000, you know, lifetimes back. And he could see where he was born, what village he was born in, his name, who his parents was, what he did. And he just saw this endless stream of rebirths that he'd been part of. And it's kind of mythic almost the way it's described, because it's so huge, the scope of what he perceives. Then the second watch of the night, he has a different perception. And this time he perceives how beings, he's kind of like he surveys the world, and how beings are reborn based on their karma. And those beings who make good karma for themselves get reborn in good states of rebirth, like get reborn in heavenly realms. And those beings who do bad karma for themselves get reborn in bad states. For example, in Buddhist hells. And just to say that the Buddhist ideas of hells and heaven, which is a traditional part of not just Buddhism, but also kind of Indian kind of cosmology, is that people's time in these places is always temporary as we're cycling through all the different realms where we can get reborn. So in the first watch of the night, he saw kind of rebirth. A rebirth is a really, for him, you know, maybe a reality or a mythic reality. So you see the endless stream of birth and death. And then the second watch of the night, he saw the conditions that influence how a person's reborn. That they're reborn based on their karma. Good karma, good birth. Bad karma, bad birth, to be very simplistic. The third watch of the night, and this is where the first two watches was not particularly a Buddhist insight. It's understood to be, many people had this insight. But it's the insight or the transformation that happened in the fourth watch of the night, which is really described as his enlightenment. But it's built on the first two. And he says in the third one, he says that he understood or he perceived or he experienced the destruction. The word is quite powerful, the word that's used. But the destruction of those forces that kept him being reborn. And those forces are called the asavas. And the asavas is a very powerful word. It means, it refers partly to, before Buddhists picked it up, to an intoxicating liquid from a certain kind of tree that grew in India. It also refers to the kind of pus. You know, if you cut yourself, have pus oozing out. That's asava, apparently. So I like to translate it as the toxins or the intoxicants. Sometimes it's translated into English as the outflows or the what's a more common one? Okay, so and then and the destruction of these forces of greed, of hate, of attachment that keep a being clinging to life, lifetime after lifetime, forces for getting reborn. And so there's a kind of a sequence here where he understood about the chain of causality down through millennia. He understood the factors that affect the kind of rebirth we have. And then he understood how to step off that chain. So karma there, the understanding of karma was part of that experience of his enlightenment, the night of his enlightenment, seeing it deeply. The word karma literally means action. And it's a very, apparently, you know, it's a very common kind of word in Sanskrit or Pali. In Pali, the word's pronounced kamma. And some of us know the word. We have probably, in some ways, used the word similarly. It comes from the root kri, K-R kind of, kri. And it appears in the word Sanskrit. The san in Sanskrit means with, and krit is the same root as karma, and it means to construct or to make. And Sanskrit is a constructed language. It's a language that we've made happen, constructed. It's kind of like church Latin that's kind of been made. And or the word karuna is usually translated into English as compassion, but it has the same root, kri, which means to act. And in the dictionary, it defines, one of the definitions of karuna is holy action. So we have the idea of karma as being action. In India, in ancient India, modern India, there are many different, and probably in the modern West also, there are many different theories about action. Does action have results in the future? Can you act in certain ways to create an effect tomorrow? Or is life predetermined and action has no influence at all? It's all been set in stone long before you were born and you're just kind of going through your emotions. You think you're in control, but what's going to happen to you this afternoon was preordained. And you just go along with what's happening. So your actions have no bearing. What you do, you know, you can't really do anything to change that. That was one theory of action in ancient India. And there were various forms. There were ideas that when you were born, you were born originally, way back at the beginning of the cosmos, first, you know, rebirth, first birth. You were born with a certain store of karma, and if you did nothing, you could kind of unwind that spring. You could kind of empty that, and if you can empty it all from you, then you could become enlightened. You can become free, liberated. And so, like the Jain religion, people had this belief. You couldn't really do anything except do nothing. And so, ultimately, the goal in Jainism, you starve yourself to death as you do nothing. Because you don't want to add to that karma at all. You don't want to tighten the spring anymore. The Buddha belonged to a school or kind of a trend of thought in ancient India where they wanted to say that action is consequential. That what you do, how you act, has consequences. And that's kind of, for most of us, operate that way, don't we? You know, even that somehow, you know, if you don't stop for the red light, and there's a lot of traffic going the other direction, there'll be consequences. And so we take that into account as we go along. Now, there's a huge field of cause and effect that we live in. And karma, as a Buddhist spiritual concept, is a subset of the field of cause and effect. What that means is that everything that happens to you, according to the Buddha, is not happening to you because of your past karma, because of your past actions and deeds. Though some people sometimes think that way and are pressed by that kind of idea. Oh, I got sick because it's my karma to get sick. And there's kind of fatalism into kind of assuming that everything that happens to you is kind of because of your karma in the past. Everything that happens is because of cause and effect. There's a causal nexus we live in. But that causal ocean that we live in is much bigger than that particular one of karma. So if the Buddha said, for example, that some things happen to you because of biological reasons, which are not karmic. And he went through kind of ancient Indian medical kind of causes. Some things happen to you because of bile. I guess in Indian medicine, bile is a cause of illness. Another one is phlegm. And another one is the winds. Your winds are a little bit imbalanced. Another thing that can cause kind of distress or problems or whatever is if you get attacked. And the Buddha wasn't going to say that every time you get attacked, you know, if you're walking down the street and someone jumps you in the alley, that's not necessarily because of your bad karma. It's just you were in the wrong place at the wrong time. It might be part of your karmic stream, but it doesn't have to be. So a natural disaster happens. That's not necessarily, you don't attribute that to your karma, just, you know, that's just what's happening and somehow you were there. The subcategory of cause and effect that the Buddha attributed to karma is that chain of cause and effect that is set in motion by your intentions, by your intending things. And the Buddha compared or equated karma with intention. And it's been pointed out in various points in human history, different religious people have picked up on the tremendous importance of intention. Our inner life, and how what we intend, whether our inner life is intended by good or by bad, and it's not just simply a matter of appeasing the gods, which it was in ancient Vedic India. You know, your good and bad happen because you appeased the gods. You made sacrifices and to the gods, and you asked them, please, you know, make my crops grow. And so it's not just a matter of, you know. So rather than looking externally to cause and effect, there's a turning around looking. Actually, what happens inside of you, your intentions, the quality of your intentions, has a bearing in this chain, in this big field of cause and effect. And where do we see intention having an effect? How does that work? Intention certainly can be seen in the present moment. If I sit here and decide that I don't know, that I would like to do something really kind, really wonderful and generous for all of you here. It would be really great if I could just kind of do something great. And just that intention, if I don't get mixed up with self being self-conscious and wondering if you really are going to like it and all these things, in and of itself, that intention can, in the present moment, can make me feel good. I feel kind of relaxed, I feel happy because of it. If I suddenly decide to get angry with all of you, I get kind of contracted. And that contraction is called instant karma. As we do certain things, there are consequences for doing it. And that's called instant consequences, instant karma. But also as we do things, there are we set up a kind of a momentum or that continues through time. So, for example, if maybe being angry just once doesn't do much, but if I start being angry repeatedly, then I'm setting up a momentum within me of tension, of a tendency, a predisposition to get angry. One of the exercises I like doing is when I drive on the freeway, is track my emotions and my subtle emotions. Because I see, you know, very subtly that I'm driving along and someone cuts me off and I get a little bit angry. And then someone drives by who's really attractive and I feel, you know, that's nice. And then someone comes in and tailgates me and I get a little irritated. And someone drives by in this great, beautiful car and I feel a certain way. And someone's driving really slow in front of me and I feel a certain way. And you know, there's kind of kaleidoscope of kind of, you know, very, very, very subtle kind of going through. And a police car pulls up behind me and I feel a certain thing. And, you know, and so it's kind of fun to track it all. But one of the interesting things is that if I'm going, you know, for half an hour on the freeway, if I'm not paying attention, some of that's probably going on anyway, subconsciously or kind of not so conscious. But if there's a particular kind of emphasis in how I'm reacting, if I'm always reacting kind of in an irritated way with the other cars, each little moment of irritation is nothing. But after the end of the half an hour, I might arrive in my destination stressed and tense because of the accumulation of those little moments of intending, little moments of reacting to how it is. So we set up momentum in our body through how our body is. Body gets more and more relaxed or more and more tense. There's holding patterns we hold in our body. There's deep knots. People who, you know, who have some deep, either a single incident or a chronic kind of approach of being afraid about something, you know, their shoulders get chronically tight or they hold a knot some deep in their body. And it's said that part of what happens in Vipassana practice is slowly is the unraveling of these knots of this, what people say is the karma that's stored in our body. These reactions and intending in ways that somehow, the momentum that's stored somehow in our body. And so that could have karmic effects on our illness, for example. Some illness could be seen as a result of the way we've lived our lives. And if we go around intending and living lives of being angry or generous, it probably has some effect on how we carry our body and our stress level in our body. And we know that stress has a big impact on our health. So it's not the only impact on our health, but it certainly can be one. There's also traces in our memory. And it's not so uncommon for people who meditate to, especially early in a person's meditative practice, to have memories surface that they haven't thought about for 20 years. Wow, I said that to that person 20 years ago? That's terrible. And then feel great regret, perhaps. Oh, wow, how could I have done that? And they call up the person and say, remember me? No. Well, I want to apologize. that's nice. sometimes, you know, it's really surprising what gets stored somehow in the psyche and might reappear when the psyche gets relaxed enough and not distracted enough or the conditions kind of a deepening within us. So there seems to be some kind of causeway for a chain of cause and effect set in motion by our intention. In classic Buddhism, that causeway is sometimes described as a causeway of merit. So if you do a lot of good karma, you create merit. And if you create a lot of bad karma, you're creating demerit, or, probably that's the best thing to say for now. And but how does merit happen? Is there a big scorecard up there that is keeping track? And someone tallies it up at the end, and it weighs out the good and the bad, and decides what's going to happen. I don't think the Buddha had that kind of notion, but the idea of karma and merit and this lends itself to a kind of supernatural or metaphysical kind of view, an extreme form. And there are Buddhists who actually go around with merit books. And you do certain meritorious things. You go to a temple, make offerings. And you ask the abbot to put a stamp or write in your merit book what you've done. And then you have this book, because you can't rely on the record keeper up there. So you have your own kind of book. And then when you die, it's buried with you or burned with you or something. You take it along with you, so you have this little document. So I don't know about those kinds of things. It seems a little odd to me. But merit is kind of classically. In one place, the Buddha says merit is happiness. So if you do things that bring greater happiness and sense of well-being to yourself, that in itself is the merit, which is setting up the conditions for greater happiness, greater well-being in the future. The Buddha also said that if you want to try to really understand the full scope of karma, this chain of cause and effect that's set in motion by our intending, your head will explode. I think what I understand from this is not a threat, don't think about it, but rather it's just too hard. It's just it's just too difficult to figure out how all this stuff works. It's kind of like if you put a pebble throw one pebble into a pond, and you see beautiful ripples going out. And then you throw another pebble in, and you see two pebbles in, and you see the ripples, and then they meet each other, and they form other ripples. And that's kind of, you can track that. But then, you take a handful of thousands of, pebbles, and you have 1,000 people doing it all at once, and they all throw it into the pond at the same time. You can't really track the ripples anymore and how they bump into each other and affect each other, and your probably head will explode if you try to, graph it all out and understand. So we live in this very complex world, and we don't just simply have one intention, but we have, many intentions through the day and through life, and they, bump into each other and affect each other in all kinds of ways. And so it's really hard to know the full scope of the ways that things work. The Buddha said that if you primarily live a good life, and you have one little transgression, you yell at your spouse or whatever, it's not really going to have a big impact on your karma. However, if you primarily lived a bad life, then yelling at your spouse will actually have a big impact. It's almost as if the karmic consequences are different depending on the container you put that in. So the Buddha, in talking about this, the Buddha said, if you take a teaspoon of salt and put it in the Ganges River, which I guess was, fresh water, it does not really going to change the taste of the Ganges River. But if you put a teaspoon of salt in a small cup of water, that cup of water becomes undrinkable. So if you've done a lot of good in your life, then you do a little bit, put a little bit of salt in there, a little bit of bad action, and it's not really going to have much impact. But if you already have it really tight and constricted, it's going to have a big impact on your karmic stream, what's going to happen. So in terms of thinking about karma, the way it plays out in Buddhist spiritual life is that it's the teaching of karma is pointing us to the present moment. The importance of paying attention to the present moment. So another one of Buddhist teaching is that the present moment is a very important place to be and to pay attention. Because it's in the present moment that you make your choices. Choice only happens in the present. And so the emphasis in mindfulness, is part of it is to be attentive enough to track the choices you make or the choices you have to make, and then to pay attention to what you're intending in making that choice. What's the flavor of that intention? If you go, you know, if you want to go and feed the homeless, it could seem on the surface as being a wonderful intention. But if you pay careful attention to why you're making the choice to feed the homeless, you might find that you're doing it because you want to look really good for your neighbors. If you can look like Saint Mother Teresa's, then your neighbors will probably like you more. Now, that's not a particularly wholesome or skillful or useful intention to have, to build up your ego out of being generous. Say that a deer comes into your yard, and a neighbor dog, you know, wants to chase it, and so you throw a stone at the deer. It can seem, if someone watches you throwing a stone at a deer, they go, boy, that's a bad person, this poor little deer, this Bambi. But if they realize that your intention is really to help the deer, then that's actually a good intention. So part of mindfulness is to look, what am I intending in doing this thing? The bigger the choice, the more important it is to ask yourself, what's the intention here? Why do I want to do it? The intention is consequential. If you do good acts, but the intention is selfish, ultimately at the source, you're then reinforcing that tendency to be selfish. You're creating these momentum within us, this disposition, and somehow there's a chain of cause and effect within us. Maybe it's unseen. It's hard to know where all this goes, how it moves through time. But you're creating the tendencies for having bad karma in the future. Being selfish creates bad karma. How does that bad karma manifest itself in 20 years? I'm not sure. Maybe it's hard to know how it's going to manifest itself. Maybe it's manifest itself as being really lonely. I've known people who've been so self-obsessed for so long, they wake up one morning and realize, wow, I'm really alone. I know people, but I don't really know them. I never took the time to get to know them because I was always trying to get to know myself or trying to get them to know me or whatever. So to pay attention to our intention. How this, the idea of rebirth that's tied into the karma in the myth of the Buddha's enlightenment, I don't know how important that is in terms of the belief or the confidence in karma. The Buddha said that it's right view, it's appropriate, it's necessary to have confidence in karma. Without any confidence in karma, you can't really follow the Buddhist path. So that can seem like a kind of very strong statement. It is a strong statement, but it's kind of a very, I think, a very straightforward thing. If you don't have some confidence in the efficacy of your actions, some confidence in the value of doing and acting, why would you do anything? If you want to learn a musical instrument, you have to have confidence that practicing that instrument is going to bear fruit, and you're going to be able to learn that skill through time, that it's efficacious to practice. It's very simple, right? If you want to learn any skill, you have to believe, you have to have confidence. If you don't have any confidence in your ability to change and develop something over time, why would you do it? So the teaching of karma is what, to have confidence in karma is to have confidence that how you act now has consequences in the future, and there are some consequences that are more desirable than others. And in knowing that there are more desirable consequences than others, you have confidence that if you act one way, you're more likely to have those beneficial consequences into the future. Without the stronger a person's confidence is in their ability to initiate change, the more motivated and more confident they'll be in their spiritual practice. If they have no confidence, there'll be no confidence in spiritual practice. Why bother? So it's a very simple idea of karma at its heart. And this is where I think a lot of you, probably all of you, have that level of confidence to some degree. That, you know, your actions do have an effect. You do things because, you know, it's going to have an effect. So the teaching of karma also then implies that you have some understanding of what is beneficial for yourself and what is not beneficial, and that you're interested in changing your karmic stream in the direction of what is more beneficial for you, rather than just being a victim of just circumstances and letting things just unfold the way they are. You actually take responsibility for this karmic stream. So what happens to you, what's happening to you in the moment, what arrives here in this particular situation, the situation you've been born into, is just there because of causes and conditions, some of it because of your karma perhaps, some of it because of your bile, or whatever. And but the key thing for a Buddhist spiritual life is then, once something is here, how do you respond to it? How do you act on it? And that is that's really kind of the thrust of important part of Buddhism is, how do you respond to what's given to you in life? If you respond in a kind of victim mentality, oh poor me, that's creating a certain karma. That sets into motion a certain kind of cause and effect. If you respond to it, oh, I'll do the best I can with this, and not wallow it in it or whatever, you create a different stream, a different kind of momentum. It's not karma is not a moralistic teaching. It's more about having some understanding of a stream of cause and effect, and being concerned about what's beneficial and what's not. Someone told me recently that nature is based on cause and effect. Certain theistic religions have the idea of reward and punishment. So the idea of karma is more in this nature side of things. It has to do with cause and effect, not about punishment and reward. So what's the chain of cause and effect you're setting in motion? Which means I lost my train of thought. I think that was where I lost my train of thought by going into that tangent.
Although, can I ask a question?
Please.
It seems that, in a sense, morality or sila is a strong foundation to have, to operate from in your life,
yeah,
to behave in a beneficial way, therefore affecting the karma in this moment.
Right. So he says he wants to ask about morality or ethics, and that it seems that living an ethical life does have a big impact on your ethics. So I think, yes, living ethically does have a big impact on this chain of cause and effect we send into motion. But the chain of karma is much larger than ethics. And it's not a matter of reward and punishment. It's a matter of, you know, what we're setting into motion, cause and consequence, a cause and effect. Oh, this is what I was going to say. Now I think we're back on track. Is back to the Buddha. That the Buddha was critical of some of the ancient Indian ideas of that people's status as a human being was something that they were born with. So you had the notion of the Brahmanical class, the Brahmins. And they're born in, people are born as being Brahmins, or they're born as being what used to be called untouchables. And then society would treat them that way, or the Brahmins would hold themselves kind of, you know, superior to everybody else. And the Buddha would said, oh, a person is not superior from other people because of how they were born. And some people have said this is kind of an anti-racist kind of teaching of the Buddha, because the Brahmins tended to be a whiter class in India than other Indians, lighter skinned. And people are not born superior. But the people are superior, you know, or noble or worthy or whatever, based on their actions, based on how they respond to what's given. So if we respond in generous and wise and compassionate ways, that's what makes a person a noble person, a worthy person. That's what makes a person a Brahmin, not how they're born. So the emphasis here is, again, is to going back and how is it we're responding to what's given to us? And there are tragic ways of being, tragic things that happen to human beings. The teaching of karma is not a teaching to oppress us because of what's happened to us, but rather is an encouragement, as difficult as these teachings might sound, given what's happening to us, to take responsibility for how we respond to that. And the measure of who we are as a human being has to do with how we respond to what's given to us, not what has happened to us. And we always have the opportunity to respond in new ways. The Buddha said, if karma was an absolute law, that if what you did today will directly affect what happens tomorrow, you have no space for the spiritual life. You have no place for discovering freedom. But because you can have an impact, an influence on this karmic stream, because there's kind of, in a sense, free choice, free will in Buddhism, you can actually change that karmic stream for the better. Or you can change in such a way that you can step off it and become free. So, to take responsibility for how we act in the world, for how we respond, to be concerned about the consequences, and to realize that there are beneficial consequences and not so beneficial, harmful ones. To have some sense of where we're going towards, what's useful for us, is part of Buddhist spiritual life. And not just to leave it to chance, not to step outside and just say it's all been predetermined, but to actually get involved so that we can become freer in this life that we're living. That, I think, is why the Buddha emphasized karma and why Buddhism emphasizes the importance of karma. So I hope that was clear enough. I didn't meander too much. We have a few minutes if you have any more questions I'd like to ask. Yes? Collective karma. Huh? Collective karma.
Mm-hmm. But obviously it looked like they devoted their life to a lot of prayer and good things, and then they were the target of the Chinese cruelty. So in a way my mind wants to understand it.
So we have to be very careful not to use the word karma too easily. If karma is a subset of the field of cause and effect, and there are other causes besides karmic ones, then we don't want to say that everything that happens is because of people's karma. Why did that happen to the Tibetans? It's because of their karma. I mean, there are people who say that, but I don't know if we have to say that. Buddhist teaching of karma is not a teaching that tries to help us understand why something is happening now, But it's rather a teaching that says, now, given that it's happened, how do you respond? And it could, you could say the karma of the Tibetans is of all these years of centuries of practice is manifested in the story of the monk who was imprisoned for 20 years and tortured. And when he was released, the Dalai Lama asked him, was he ever in danger? And he said, yes, I was in danger. The Dalai Lama thought, oh, he meant danger of losing his life, perhaps. And the monk said, I was in danger of losing my compassion for the Chinese. Now, there has to be a lot of good karma set in motion for a person to maintain that equanimity and dedication to compassion, even under that kind of circumstance. And that's where we find the karma more clearly. So he wasn't being, even though terrible things were happening to him, he wasn't being submerged by himself. He wasn't himself succumbing to hate and anger and despair because of what was happening. Yes?
So, are you saying that it's more governed by your response, though? Having anger doesn't necessarily entail that, doesn't mean you have bad karma, but more that you have anger, and then you have a decision point, like what is your response, and that will determine your karma?
So the question is, this teaching of karma is not about whether or not you're angry, but rather whether you act on the anger. Is that right? Unfortunately, in some ways that's true. But unfortunately, I think it's very hard to see a very sharp line between the arising of anger and an intention to act on it. Because anger itself is a kind of intention. So it might feel like anger is just kind of coming. But once anger has arisen, then the teaching of the karma says, given that's what's arisen, then how do you respond to the rising of anger? And if you can just leave it alone, that's very wise. If you could compost it into loving kindness, that's very wise. But if you take it up and act with it, then you're furthering your karma. And probably you're creating a lot stronger karmic momentum than you were if it just simply arose and passed. Could be. So, I mean, if you watch anger carefully, it could be arising for other conditions. I mean, it's possible that, I'll give you an example that I've been told I shouldn't do anymore because it's so silly. But it's hard to come up with examples. Is say that, I'm really a macho kind of guy. And it's really important that you all know that I'm kind of macho. And the way I prove it to all of you is I drive this really hot car. And I like to park it right outside there. So, and I like to stand out there so you kind of dangle the keys so you really see, what a great guy I am, because that's the proof, right? And then the car, someone damages the car a little bit. And I take it to the shop. It's my karma. And they give me a replacement car to drive for a few days, and it's an old little beat up little kind of Volkswagen Bug. And now I have to park it in front of here, and you guys, So at some point in this chain of having the accident and being given the Volkswagen, I get angry. It's an unfortunate circumstance to have me angry, however, to have an accident. But my anger is stimulated not by this unfortunate thing of the accident. It's stimulated by the fact this is putting a big dent in my ego. And my ego is something I'm holding. There's already an intention to create a certain kind of self. So that's already creating karma. And in that it's creating karma, one manifestation of that karma is that I'm predisposing myself that if there's an accident, that I'm going to then get tight and upset, which creates further karma if I act on an anger. Is that... Yes.
I'd like to go back to the dog and the deer.
Yeah.
And intent. And something that came up for me was, would there be a vast difference in intent if you try to deter or control a dog as opposed to letting the deer go out of fear?
Oh, you mean because you're frightening the deer? Well, I think the way, I believe, I don't know, you know, if I try too hard, my head will explode. But I believe the way this kind of, this logic works is that if we're focusing on our, on the karmic stream, the karmic stream is affected by our intention. If our intention is good, we might still be confused about what's wisest to do out in the world. We might still cause harm in the world. We might regret that harm. We might have to go to jail because of that. All kinds of things might happen because of our stupidity. But our karma hasn't been affected negatively because the intention was good to begin with. So the intention might have been, in the moment, the best I could think of was I really want to try to help compassionately this deer. Best I could think of was to throw a little rock in its direction. And so that's really where the force of the momentum is in that good intention. The fact that the deer was frightened has a cause and effect, does set in motion certain cause and effect, but it's not the same as karmic. It might come back to the person who realizes later, oh, I frightened that deer. I regret that. Now, a regret is maybe a different, belongs to a different category of cause and effect than that one that has to do with karma. Is that making sense?
It does. And in going to the dog, it's I kind of had a more positive connotation on the deer than I would on trying to control or forcefully control the dog from doing an act that it was naturally.
So what I imagine is that if a person had the wherewithal to realize they want to try to help the deer and make the deer go away, but they want to do it in such a way that doesn't frighten the deer, that maybe there's more good karmic kind of phenomena going on, more good intentions happening there, that would set in motion a stronger flow of good karmic momentum than if you simply picked up the first stone you could find and threw it and into fright or whatever. So how do you explain things that happen to children where they seem to be born certain ways or have certain things happen to them that they don't really have the chance to have karma? A baby, suddenly something happens and it's tragic or whatever. Myself, I tend to shy away from the kind of analysis that goes to past lives. And in fact, I tend to shy away from any kind of... from using the teaching of karma too much as one to try to explain why something happened. Sometimes reviewing the why is useful because we can learn from that. If I drive my half an hour on the freeway and arrive someplace tense, reviewing, I've been irritated by every driver on the freeway, and realizing that cause and effect, you learn from your experience that way, which is good. So some reviewing can be very helpful. But I shy away from especially past life kind of explanations of, this is why, past life experiences is why this is what's happened now. I'm pretty content that the teachings of karma focus on the importance of us looking, how do we respond given what's happened? So we're not using karma to explain everything that occurs, but we're using this understanding of action to emphasize where we can make the biggest difference in the present. Some people want karma to be a theory of justice, that schmuck is going to get his due rewards, you know. He's such a terrible guy. He's done all these different terrible things, and he made a fortune, you know. And he's just living this great hedonistic lifestyle. And look, he's dying. He's dying. He's 92 years old, and he's dying a smooth death. He's dying in his sleep, and he's taking it all with him, in a sense, you know. How could that be? There's no justice. I want justice. Well, justice is in his next lifetime. So we want a theory of justice, but I don't think we need to. I don't think that's really the purpose of this either. That's more kind of like our trying to make order out of it all. It's very simple. This teaching of karma. It's like, given what's happening, can we take some responsibility for how we respond to that, so that we create a better momentum into the future? Now, there are Buddhists who will explain that things that happen to people are because of past karma. And there's some wonderful, I don't know wonderful, but some amazing equations that are made. And the Buddha made some of these also. You can read in the sutra some of these. If you kill people, you might get reborn as, maybe you get reborn as a ant that some little boy finds, and the boy loves to pull the legs off the ant. So there's some explanations given like that. So the Buddha that's not the explanation the Buddha gives, but he does give kind of an equation. If you do X, then the next life Y will happen. Some other ones that are given, I know I heard one recently, that if you speak harshly, if you use harsh speech, you'll end up driving on rough roads. And if you want your road, your driveway to be smooth someday, your road in front of your house that has a lot of potholes or whatever, then you should cultivate kind, smooth speech. And then that sets into motion the karmic motion that someday you'll have. But what happens to children? So I don't know. Maybe it's past karma, past lifetimes. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's bile or winds, genetics. Who knows? And it breaks my heart what happens to children and to adults. And I'd love to understand it. I'd love to have an understanding of the universe where I can understand why what happens happens. They think what? If they're lucky.
If they're lucky. And if they're under tremendous pressure, whether emotional, physical, or whatever, they could be acting, not that it's okay or whatever, but they could be acting unskillful, let's just put it that way. And then they create karma.
Right.
And then it just seems,
I see. So someone has horrible experiences as children, and it kind of creates a little bit how they're disposed to live, and because of that disposition, they create bad karma for themselves. And it seems very unfortunate that they should be in a sense creating bad karma based on kind of continuing a cycle of abuse, perhaps, of what happened earlier in their lives. Yeah, it breaks my heart. It's very tragic, these things, and hopefully. Some point or other, people learn how to take that into account. In the pantheon, I'll end with this little teaching thing. In Mahayana Buddhism, they have kind of a pantheon of bodhisattvas. And bodhisattvas there's kind of what's called in scholarly circles, celestial bodhisattvas, who are kind of like, almost like, function almost like gods. Even though they're not supposed to be gods in Buddhism. They're kind of like celestial beings. And some of them are help, like Avalokiteshvara goes and helps people who are suffering. And they represent different archetypes of perhaps. And there's but all of the bodhisattvas are lay people. They're not, except for one. And one is a monk. It's in Japanese it's called Jizo Bodhisattva, in Sanskrit Teshigarbha Bodhisattva. And And Jizo is the one, is the bodhisattva for children and for people in desperate straits, like homeless and people in really desperate, down and out kind of situations. And what I take, what I find that's interesting about that is that the monastic, the monk, is a very powerful archetype. And there's a certain kind of psyche, a certain kind of being, people. They almost need to have some kind of almost archetype step into their life to really make an impact, to really help them and kind of pull them out of the mud that their situation they're in. And so sometimes sometimes you need something like that to really wake someone up. Isan Dorsey, the great Zen saint in San Francisco, Castro District, wonderful man. He was down and out kind of life and drugs. And he saw a picture of Ramana Maharshi in his stupor. And that photograph kind of woke him up. So he kind of changed the course of his life and became a Zen student, a Zen priest, and became a great Zen teacher in San Francisco from that one. So sometimes, you know, and so hopefully, you know, what is it that wakes any of us up so that we decide that we can live our life differently, that we can make a change, that we can start paying attention and respond differently? What is it that does it for us? So I hope this is useful. I hope it gives you food for thought, and I hope that encourages you to have confidence in your capacity to make a difference in your own life, and that you really use that capacity in beautiful ways. Thank you.